here's a thing I haven't done for about 20 years or so. Write down the serial numbers of my traveler's checks. Remember when you had to do that? When you'd go to the bank and buy a whole sheaf of checks and then record the serial numbers so you could cancel them if they got lost or stolen? That used to be such an ingrained part of the travel experience, and now it's just disappeared. It's gone. In the same way so many rituals of travel have vanished in the last 20 or 30 years. Using a map and figuring out how to refold it, writing aerograms, getting film developed, making a plan to meet up with people in 3 months' time and actually having to stick to it. Travel has changed, immeasurably, irreversibly. Most times it's changed for the better, but in some ways it might have also changed for the worse. Hi, I'm Ben Groundwater, and you're listening to Flight of Fancy, the traveller.com.au podcast. Today's episode is for all those people who went through the trials and tribulations, the joys and the hardships of travelling in the world back in the 1980s and 1990s. If you remember Post-Restant, then this episode is for you. If you remember Deutschmarks and guilders, then this episode is for you. If you remember cashing travellers' checks, trying to refold maps, sending faxes to reserve hostel beds, carrying rolls of film, and clutching a guidebook that you referred to as your Bible, then this episode is for you. What do you miss from those times? What are you glad is gone? Joining me to discuss this, I have two fellow travellers who at least vaguely remember the 80s and 90s. First up, she's a long-term collaborator on Flight of Fancy, who took her first big trip overseas when she was six, which I'm guessing was in the 90s sometime.
2000 star.
Uda Juncker.
Hi, Ben.
Great to have you on board. Also joining us, he's the editor of Fairfax's Sun Herald newspaper and someone whose first trip away was hitchhiking across the UK with his step-grandmother when he was 15, Liam Phelan.
Hello.
Hi,
how
Liam.
Are you?
Thanks for coming along. Can you tell us about this hitchhiking trip? How did that all come about?
Yeah, so that was, I travelled with my family and stuff when I was younger than that, but that was my first kind of stepping off point without my parents, basically. And my step-grandmother was a pretty extraordinary woman. She was partners with my grandfather, who was also a fairly out-of-the-box kind of guy. He was an Irish writer, and he did 15 years in jail. He wrote a number of kind of award-winning and best-selling books, and he was an inveterate traveller. He travelled across Europe.
Sounds brilliantly
States.
Irish, something about that, that combination of lawlessness and talent for the written word.
Yeah, he was a character. But she was an amazing woman. And in hindsight, like, you don't realise these things when you're a kid, obviously, but she basically taught me how to hitchhike. So a lot of people kind of go, hey, you know, hitchhike, just all you do is stick your thumb out. Well, she was kind of a professional tramp, basically. She was a woman. She had a caravan but no car. So essentially she would hitchhike around and hop in your car whichever mark she picked, and chat and kind of ingratiate herself, and then basically talk people into towing her caravan around. So she went from place to place.
So she actually had to hitch something to the car.
That she was, literally was a yeah, it was a literal hitchhiker. So she was also an artist, so she could do little sketches and that kind of thing. She was a poet. She had lots of scrapbooks, and she would kind of sell these to people. She was also a professional gambler. So as well as taking me across. We basically caught the ferry from Dublin, where I grew up, and travelled across and landed in Holyhead in west of Wales. And then we basically went from Holyhead, hitchhiked across up through Chester, which is an old walled city in England, a beautiful, beautiful old city, and then down towards Leicester, where she had her caravan. So basically, she was able to, you know, kind of teach her how to handle the road and how to approach people, how to travel safely. Which, as a woman, she had travelled across North Africa, the States, right up into Alaska, pretty much across continental Europe. So it was a great adventure for me and a great opportunity.
She sounds like an amazing woman.
She was a really, she was an amazing woman. And so for me, it was just a great way to kind of step off into the wild, but with I had the master looking on.
Net so, there. Uta, what was travel like on your first ever trip? Do you remember too much of it?
I actually remember an extraordinary amount from that trip.
Yeah.
I think because we were absorbing so many new experiences, we spent several months travelling around Europe and mostly driving. And looking back, the thing that sort of makes me think, wow, is the signposting, just the generic signposting throughout Europe when you're driving from one country to another, from one part of a country to another, there was a lot less of it. It was like they assumed everyone knew where they were going. You know, these days so much is set up for the fact that you've got lots of foreigners or people not from this part of the country coming through. And it was, you would have your big roadside atlas that was this, I was about to say the size of a phone book, but not many people remember what a phone book is. My references are so out of date.
It's like 20 Kindles stacked on top of each other.
Exactly. And you'd be frantically looking up things going, no, the B3 goes left at Courchevel or wherever you were, you know. And it was like, well, did we pass Courchevel or did we not? No one was quite sure. And there wasn't this idea that everyone immediately spoke a couple of other languages, at least in tourist areas. But part of this sense that Europe was less explored was also the fact that I can distinctly remember being on a beach somewhere in Spain. I can't tell you where it was, but, you know, it wasn't remote. Mm-hmm. There were towns and things. And we went and picked mussels off the rocks and cooked them over a campfire and skinny dipped.
Right.
And I don't think you'd be doing that on any beach in Spain very much these days.
I don't know. I'd like to think you could still do that. Maybe you can't. I don't know.
Well, not like right in your town.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Somewhere remote.
One of the things that sticks out from my first ever trip without my parents when I was 17, I was traveling with a mate of mine and we were supposed to get from Boston down to stay with some friends of the family in New York. And I didn't realize that when I was told New York, it was New York State, not New York City. And so my friend and I went against all advice that we'd been given and jumped on a direct train to Grand Central because we figured that would be a lot faster way to get there instead of going to the outer suburbs of New York. And so we ended up in Grand Central Station in New York with no idea of what we were doing or where we were supposed to be. There was no one there to meet us. And the only thing to do was to find a payphone and call someone, which is not a thing that you ever have to deal with anymore. And we couldn't work the payphone. We got all these quarters, and there was a certain amount of money you needed to put in the payphone to be able to make a long distance call. And every time we got to anywhere near that amount, it would just shoot all of the change back out at us. And we couldn't figure it out. We were there for probably an hour or so trying to work out how we were going to get. We ended up making a reverse charges call, a collect call, and that got us out of trouble. But now you would have a mobile phone and you would be looking on your map and you think, oh, this is not where I was told to go.
You'd look up the railway timetable on your map, you know, before you even left home. Right. I mean, on your phone, sorry, before you even left home.
Yeah, yeah.
It's easy. And that was the thing, was getting information in the old days. I mean, it really was. It was a thing that if you wanted to catch a train, you had to go to the train station and you had to ask.
Yeah.
You know, was there a train to this place? And if so, what days did it go and which one could you get? And,
yeah.
And, you know, these days.
I think that's a key difference between travelling now and travelling back then was, like you say, to get information, you basically had to talk to people.
Yeah.
You had to go and front up. If you didn't speak the language, you just had to go and make a fool of yourself.
Right.
I never forget the Greek word for eggs because at one point I had to go and try and mime a chicken in a little local store in Crete. And much to the amusement of the entire village. And I think long after they knew what I was after, they still just kept me going. And once I heard that word, I never forget it. Whereas these days, of course, you could just chuck in, you know, Google Translate eggs and off you go. So
yeah,
that was a key difference. It you know, not having kind of the internet essentially forced you to really engage with people.
Mm.
And I think that is one of the great things about travel back then. And possibly that's one of the downsides of the internet is it lets you get off the hook a lot easier.
Yeah, I think we will probably all agree that the internet is the single biggest change to travel in the last 20 or 30 years. It's just everything is different now. You were stuck in a train, trying to buy a train ticket for about 2 days in India at one point.
Yeah, right? I had an incident that is burned on my mind about just trying literally for 2 days to get a train ticket. So it took me best part of one day to get what I thought was a ticket. I got it in my hand. I was pretty delighted. I fronted up to the train and they went, no, that's not the ticket. That's the bit of paper you need to go and buy the ticket.
Right.
And that had taken me about 8 hours to get this first bit.
Right.
So, and of course, as it turned out, which I didn't realise, was it was some big holiday there and I didn't know that. So I kind of turned up at the worst possible
right,
time.
Okay.
2 days, I was travelling with a guitar. I remember at one point just literally having to launch myself. It was so crowded. I waited politely for a gap. One train went, I waited politely again, another train went, and finally I just got my guitar and just launched myself, and that was kind of what you had to do.
Yeah.
And you had to talk to people and you had to try and get that kind of information. You couldn't get it in advance.
Yeah.
So
I think actually Indian train system is probably one of the few that that I don't know if modern technology has completely taken over there. I think there's still a fair bit of queuing and a fair bit of frustration.
I would imagine. I don't think they've quite nailed it yet. So,
yeah, I'm still not sure if you can book tickets online for Indian trains, can you?
I don't know, but I would be surprised.
Certainly not from outside of the country. I think from inside the country maybe you can now, but it's still, a bit of a nightmare. But Uta, you must have noticed that, booking things like booking hotels and booking flights and all of that is completely different
and
now.
And even just planning out, I remember, and this was quite late, would have been the 90s. I remember I was going to Chile for the first time, and I was stopping over in Santiago on my way somewhere, and I had a day. And I managed to book a hotel, which I had to do by calling them up in the middle of the night, because that was when you called the hotels and fake Spanish at them and got a room. And then I also knew that on my one day there, I wanted to go to this particular museum, and I was able to look up the address of the museum, but nothing else. Mm-hmm. So I basically had to go to the airport, get in a cab, get to the hotel, and say to the hotel person, well, where is this museum and how do I get there and when is it open? And of course it had just shut and all those things. There was a sense that the adventure really started when you went there.
Yeah.
These days, exactly what you're doing.
If you want to kind of remind yourself of what travel used to be in that sense, go to Japan, because a lot of great restaurants in Japan don't have websites. They don't have any facility for emailing your reservation. If you want to reserve a table, you've got to call up and try and figure out how you're going to express to them that you want to come and eat at their restaurant at a certain time.
Yeah.
A lot of attractions don't have, things posted in English about when they're going to be open. It's very much the kind of old school style of traveling.
It is. And you find really helpful people, and then you just hold them hostage and pump them
don't let them go.
Week of stuff.
That's right. I think it does. It gives you a taste of what life used to be like. And there's still a lot of countries. I mean, I think the thing is the internet has changed everything. It's transformed the way we can acquire information both before and kind of during travel. But there are still a lot of places where it doesn't work.
That's true.
Where where you can still have to rely on the old school methods.
Right. You actually don't have to step far off the beaten track to find that either, do you?
No, that's right. I know bits of Australia that you can do that in.
I was riding a scooter around the Mekong Delta fairly recently. And in one sense, it was so much easier than it ever would have been, because I had a mobile phone which had Google Maps on it. And there's a website you can go to, and it overlays a sort of a suggested route into your Google Maps, and you can just sort of follow along.
Nifty.
It's amazing. Wow. 4 days and I was never lost or worried for a second. But at the same time, you're in places where no one speaks a word of English, where there's no place to sort of, reserve a hotel room in advance. There's no way to go out to a restaurant and expect to find an English menu. You're back to real old school style travel out there. Which is great. It's nice to know that that still exists, I think, and that it's so easy to access.
Although I have to say, I don't miss the trudging from hostel to hostel trying to find one that had a room at the end of a long day.
And the thing with the internet is it's changed everything, and there's a lot of changes I think are negative. I think we've definitely lost some things. But, of course, it's also opened up a lot of possibilities, like you say, Ben.
Yeah.
So as for every negative, there's really, you can suddenly find a lot of information you couldn't have found before, and it's allowed us to break down. I think, because I travel a lot in the 80s and 90s, and what there was a real scene. So there was the guidebook scene. So
right.
Lonely Planet was the Bible.
Yeah.
Everyone, had their copy of Lonely Planet. Yeah. It was the only piece of information.
And you would run into the people over and over again in the
same country,
or even different countries, because you're all reading the same book and staying at the same places.
Exactly. So you could travel across Central America, for instance, and just bump into the same people repeatedly, different countries, Southeast Asia, the same. And you'd kind of, meet up in Thailand, wouldn't see each other for a while. Suddenly you'd all pop up in Vietnam.
Yep.
Everyone kind of went to the same places.
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
was a bit of a, that was the downside. And the internet's allowed everybody to be a lot more flexible, so you can get a lot more information, so we're not all kind of corralled into the same limited accommodation options, limited restaurant options, that kind of thing. And that's an amazing thing. You can turn up in pretty much any city and put in best coffees or best dumplings or best whatever, and you can kind of suddenly find yourself eating with more local people, and that's a fantastic thing.
For sure. I also really enjoy being able to wander in a city and legitimately get lost, but always have this safety net of this wonderful thing in my pocket that I can pull out and open up Google Maps and it'll put a little blue dot on exactly the place that I am now. And I can very easily find my way home from there. Yeah. Probably on public transport, because it will tell me where to go and catch the bus and which number to look out for. That's a pretty amazing thing, right? You can get into these places that you wouldn't have probably had the guts to go and try before.
It is really, really cool. But I have to say, I actually still love a map.
Oh, really? And do you travel with a map?
I will, like, wherever I can pick up a map, I will have one. I will plan out what I'm doing.
Wow, I get given maps sometimes. I'm like, what am I going to do with this thing? No, I don't even know how to put it back together.
No, they're great because you can map out where you're going to go and sort of think, well, I could do that. Oh, look, while I'm there, I could go over there. That's quite good, isn't it? And then, you know, you put it in your pocket because, of course, you're too cool to ever get out your map while you're walking. And then it isn't until you get really lost that you have to sort of sit down and buy a coffee somewhere and sort of pull the map halfway furtively out of your bag. And
that's a bit I really don't miss, actually, because you obviously stand out as a tourist and a lost and vulnerable tourist when you pull out a big folding map.
Nowhere to hide when you've got a map that's the size of a small table.
Now, at least if you're looking at your phone, you could be emailing someone or something.
Yeah, but you see, this is the trick about sitting in a nice cafe with a coffee and you pull out your map. And you're kind of like, you're planning your next adventures. You're not lost. Yeah, you know exactly where you want to go. You're just working out what the most scenic route is.
How do you navigate now, Liam?
I tend to use my phone. I love maps, but it's funny, I don't travel with them anymore. Like, yeah. I used to travel, and, yep. You know, it was funny, in your intro there, you were talking about the, you know, folding a map. I was always very bad at folding maps. So my maps were always incredibly tatty. And
they got folded, just not in any way that they were intended.
So that's definitely something that I've lost. And, you know, you mentioned it, Uta, and you realise a lot of things you don't realise you lose. Like, it's like, you know, now I just use my phone. I wouldn't think about bringing a map with me. I'd certainly look at maps before I go, and I just use the phone.
Yeah, I think if anything has had more impact than the internet, it's the smartphone, which is just, you know.
Oh, you're never alone with your smartphone.
No.
it's you've got your map, you've got all the information you need about specific venues and stuff. You've got your camera in there. You can.
You've got a torch.
You've got a torch. You can text your
buddies. You have your entire music library.
You've got a compass, Emil. Everything goes really pear-shaped.
Absolutely.
It really is like having a friend with you, you know, because there's resources there. It's never like, okay, I'm now in this place and I don't know where I'm and I need to figure something out. No, you can look it up. You can text someone. You can flick back at your photos and sort of go, I've been better places, see? You can have hours of fun with it.
Do you think that ready access to a camera in particular, it kind of means that people are taking a lot more photos and possibly not really thinking about the place that they're in so much anymore?
Yeah, I read an interesting piece the other day by a technology writer, and he was saying that basically because phones are so ubiquitous now, we use them so often, they've kind of devalued the photos. So we take photos all the time.
Yeah,
we're Instagramming, it's all social media. It's almost instant, and it's everywhere. But we don't value individual shots. So we take them, we look at them quickly, and then they're disposed of.
Yeah,
whereas
back
in the days when you had film, you really had to think about what you were going to take.
How did you handle that? I never traveled with film, actually. But how would you develop as you go along, or do you just keep this big bag of films to be developed when you get home?
I was a bit of a writer, so I was actually crap at I was really bad at taking cameras, so I tended not to have a camera at all.
Yeah.
That was the thing. It was, they were big and they were bulky, and I was a bit of a purist, so my thing was you had to be there in that moment. And because you did have to take so much time to frame shots and, you know, think about what you were going to take and mess around with your film, I found that people lost a lot, you know, they missed a lot of things. So I wasn't a photographer at all.
But I tell you what, it taught you superior math skills. Because the thing was, not only did you have a roll of film which would have 24 or, if you were smart, 36 shots on it, and that's it, right? Yeah. That's the number of shots you've got of that roll of film. They came in bulk packs. So you would need to decide before you went how many rolls of film you thought you were going to need.
Right.
Because if you went to buy replacements, you would probably have to buy another bulk pack. And it'd be like, well, I've got 8, I need 2, but now I need to buy another 6-pack. Oh, my God. And so you're standing there in front of whatever you're standing on going, this looks really nice. I'm going to take a photo. And, you know, you line everything up and you do your aperture and everything. And then you go, you know what? That's really good. I might take a second photo and go, oh, hang on. I'm on 32 and I'm going to these places today and I will probably need to take another 20 shots. You would have to work all this out
really,
and
really ration out your photos.
And I just remember, I mean, it's a random memory. I don't remember what it was, but I remember some man in Sri Lanka asking me to take a photo of him. And I said, I only have 6 photos left.
Sorry.
And then, I certainly carried them home because, you know, you would never know if you could trust the quality of the developer you were. And also it's easier to carry film than it is to carry a bunch of developed ones.
Yeah.
And, you know, then you'd throw out half of them because they were useless. And then you'd put the other half in the album and then you'd have your negatives, which you would carefully store somewhere in a little shoebox if you were me, because in case you ever wanted to do reprints. And, yeah, if I took some photos with Liam in them and, you know, I said, look, I've got these nice photos. And he goes, can I have a reprint? And I was like, then I would have to go back to the photography store with my negatives.
You couldn't just email it to him.
No. I tell you.
It was also that sense of lucky dip with photos. Like you would take what you thought was a great photo and you would suddenly, you know, it would turn out and you'd think, that's terrible. And sometimes...
you would go, that's my thumb over half of it.
Sometimes, conversely, you'd take what you thought was quite an ordinary shot and it would come back and be wonderful. And it was that unexpected, it was the pleasure and the frustration.
It was really exciting going to pick up your photos because you did not know. You're right, it was a lucky dip. You did not know what you were getting.
I started traveling right when digital photography was starting to become a thing, and so I had these little memory cards which would maybe hold 30 or 40 photos max. And I was traveling in Vietnam, and I remember I didn't have a laptop or anything like that because I was a backpacker and I don't think anyone really traveled with laptops back then anyway, so you'd have to go to a photography shop with your little memory stick and they would put it into a computer and then burn your CD, your photos onto a CD for you. And then I would get 2 copies and post one home and then keep one with me in case I lost the one that I had. And it was just a whole mess around that you don't have to do anymore. What did you guys do for music back in the day? I used to carry around a big book of CDs that, you know, those sort of sleeves that you can get where you fill them up and I get like a 36. And before each trip, you would sit down with your CD collection and choose the 36 CDs.
Which and your Discman.
And my Discman. Because I have my Discman, exactly. What did you guys do?
I had a Discman and I think I used to travel with a guitar.
Oh, right.
So I used to make my own music. So that was bulky, but it was kind of like...
Were you good or were you one of those guys in the hostel where everyone's like, the Irish guy's got his heart out again?
Look, I wouldn't say I was really good, but I was good enough to hold a tune.
There you go.
And often it was good enough to get a free meal or a couple of free drinks or...
There's such a great culture of musicianship in Ireland, isn't there?
So we grow up with it. It's kind of part of our birthright, essentially. Yeah. So... It's not out of the... It's totally normal for people to travel around with instruments and to sing and to play a bit. So I used to do that and also just find music where you went. So that was a big thing, was trying to look for all the local music and trying to find weird and wonderful instruments. That was always a lot of fun.
Now you can just get anything on iTunes, basically.
just download it. Well, it's so... You can carry so much music now. But, I remember Discman and Walkman. They were pretty... when they first
pretty revolutionary
out, they were,
for travellers, I guess.
That was pretty wild.
But you're right. It was much more about going to catch some local music when you were there because... I was never big on taking CDs with me, and it was so to get the music fix, it was like you had to get out.
Right.
Unless, of course, I remember one hostel where I used to get my music fix at, 7:30 when they used to play Right on Time every morning at full volume to get you out of bed.
Music is really powerful for taking you back to places like that, isn't it? I bet you every time you hear that song now, you're straight back
and
into there.
And I tell you what else, the year that... Swedish band Ace of Base, All That She Wants Is Another Baby.
Yeah.
I was in Jamaica. So between Bob Marley, all I heard was that song.
Right. It will take you back every time.
Absolutely.
While technology may have moved on in the 25 years since Intrepid Travel ran their first trips, some things never change. Like the kind eyes of a stranger, a delicious bowl of steaming fur, or watching the sunrise from the peak of a far-flung mountain. To be intrepid is to take yourself far from the comforts of home, to embrace difference and open yourself up to new cultures and experiences. Find out more at intrepidtravel.com. I'm here with Liam Phelan and Uta Jonker. We're talking about travel back in the day, back in the 80s and 90s, the things that have changed. Guys, what about communication with back home, that's a major thing that's changed. Now, you're never away from people, really. You're always in touch.
I think that's one of the biggest losses. That's probably my biggest downside of modern travel today, is that people are never actually away. They leave, but they're always in touch. And in the old days, you disappeared. Like, it was really confronting. And but it was totally immersive. You would go to a place. If it was an out-of-the-way place, you'd obviously let friends or family know where you're going to be.
Yeah.
You could send postcards and letters and aerograms and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But if it was somewhere kind of out of the way, it would often be weeks and sometimes months, and you were just gone.
Yeah, you were really untethered from anything.
That was totally immersive. And I think that's probably the biggest loss of kind of social media and having phones and stuff like that, is I just don't get the sense today that people are, they go, but they're always connected back, and that sense of being untethered, I love that. That was something that was really challenging but really rewarding. And when you felt like you cracked into it kind of forced you to get into where you were and to be 100% there.
Yeah.
And sometimes you would get homesick or miss friends, or if you had a bad time or stuffed up or something, it could be very confronting. Mm-hmm. If sometimes we're caught without money and, you could get very badly stuck. But if you cracked it and it all went well, you really felt like you'd achieved something.
Yeah. Something interesting that I think has been lost is the sort of ability to go away to another country, to another place, and completely reinvent yourself if you want to. And be anonymous and do whatever you want, safe in the knowledge that no one would ever find out about it. You know, you could travel and you could just, you could make up stories about yourself if you wanted to, or you could just start to act in a different way and see how that fits for a while.
Because you don't have that loss of connection that Liam was talking about. You're just like, I am now here, and it's like I'm walking down this street and no one knows
I'm walking down
this street.
I used to work for a tour company taking people around Western Europe. And the kids would just go crazy, basically, over there. They would just have so much fun and just do all these things. Like, really sort of shy people would totally come out of their shells and really have a great time. And none of it would ever get back to their friends and family at home. Now, I just feel like everything is being recorded, and everything is, there's a record of everything. You're on Facebook, and so people are posting, tagging you on wherever you happen to be. You're expected to post things on Instagram, and other people are posting things about you on Instagram. And everyone knows where you are and what you're doing. And I think that would make people a little bit more wary about how they behave. And
you're right. It's permanently recorded, but it's also not examined. So one of the things I loved back in the day, when you were just gone for weeks or months at a time, is you would sit down maybe once a week or whatever and write a postcard or write a letter home, and you would think about your experience, because this was the moment for summing that experience up. And that's a totally different thing from just snapping a photo of wherever you are and posting it on Instagram.
Yeah, yeah. I would hate that if there was a digital record of the things that I got up to.
But
back in the 90s. And I don't want anyone to know about that stuff. And now it never disappears. It's always there. Do you think people would be worried about that?
I definitely do. Yeah, I think people will lose that freedom to be silly and to muck up and to do, as you say, to do things that are out of character. Because when you're overseas, no one knows what your character is.
Yeah,
so.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you guys ever have things that happened to you that now would be very avoidable? I think, Liam, you were saying you got stuck on a border somewhere.
I've had a few bad border crossings. the one that stands out most was I was traveling from Mexico across into Guatemala. And basically we ended up on the Usumacinta River there, where there was a bunch of European kind of backpackers. And we all teamed up together, and we ended up on this kind of long boat, and we went up and saw this ruins with some howling monkeys. It was pretty amazing. And then we had to get across the border, and there was no tour guides. We all spoke little bits of Spanish, information was pretty sketchy. So we ended up crossing over this border, and we ended up essentially staying in what turned out to be a brothel. It was the only place to stay
The red light didn't give it away.
It was the most unsalubrious place I've ever stayed. It was pretty horrendous. And we all, the good thing was, there was about eight of us, and we all kind of got in together. So there was a bit of a kind of esprit de corps there. We all were like, okay, we're going to have to put up with this. It's only one night. And we asked, can you get some food? And they were like, people don't normally ask for food here. You know, we're all very hungry, you know. And anyway, they gave us some semblance of food and stuff, but we had to get out of there in the middle of the night, and there were dogs. We were literally had barking dogs kind of come running at us. And then when we got on this bus, it was one little kind of creaky old local bus. We got on this bus and there were literally utefuls of trucks behind us with heavily armed guards, submachine guns. And we were like, what the hell's going on here? This is really strange. We found out subsequently, basically there'd been a massive prison outbreak and all of Mexico's worst of the worst criminals had essentially got out of prison and were on the run in this area.
Wow.
So we had no idea because we had no internet, we had no connections. So we were all travelling blindly and we did notice all these armed people and we thought, that's very strange, you know, but no sense of what it was until about a week later. And of course, when you find out, you think, oh my goodness, like that was so dangerous. Yeah, if we'd been caught by some of these characters, you know, who knows what could have happened. But at the time we were ignorant.
Blissfully ignorant.
Yeah, absolutely. We just sailed across it and just thought, I never want to stay in that town again. But there was a lot of stuff like that. Whereas obviously now you would have more access to information. So less likely to get caught like that.
And that used to be part of the disconnect, didn't it? That you were often a little bit removed from world events because you weren't just getting the updates on your phone. You know, if you wanted to learn something, particularly if you were in a country with a foreign language, you know, you would have to go and get a newspaper in a different language, which you wouldn't bother doing. So, you know, a week later you'd be going, oh, there's been a bomb explosion in here, or this government's been turfed out, or there's a president has been assassinated, whatever. And you're just like, huh, okay. Oh, well, which hostel are we going to?
I have a friend who coined the term the wilderness years, which she refers to as any time that she was away overseas and some big event, worldwide event happened. You know, there was some disaster, there was some really popular song, there was a TV show that everyone was watching. If someone references that and she has no idea what they're talking about, it's the wilderness years. It's because she was travelling and she has no idea that these things took place.
A different time-space continuum. You were just like, didn't even know that.
I was overseas when the Thredbo landed. Slide happened, and I just have no knowledge or remembrance of that event at all because I was just totally out of the loop and it basically didn't happen for me.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, these days you get texts going, oh, did you know this? And go, yeah.
You'd be all over it. That happens to me all the time. My dad is always sending me sports results while I'm traveling, which is amazing, but I already know them because I've got Wi-Fi and I've already checked. Has the fact that everything has now been reviewed, you know, TripAdvisor, everything has a review. You know what you're getting yourself into now. You know what your hotel is like. You know what the restaurant's going to be like. Do you think that's a good thing for travellers generally, or does that take a little bit of the adventure out of it?
It's a different thing.
Yeah.
It's certainly good if you know what you're after. You can go and you can pretty much program that experience for yourself. But it used to be a thing where, you know, particularly if you were going somewhere a little bit off the beaten track, like South America, it was like, okay, well, I'm going to Argentina. And it's like, okay, well, what are you going to do? It's like, find out when I get there. You know, I hear Buenos Aires is nice. You know, and it really was. So that opened you up to this sense of surprise and adventure and exploration that is largely gone these days. But, you know, I mean, I'm not saying there were people who went to Peru and came back and went, what's this place you're talking about, Machu Picchu? But you could miss things.
Yeah. I guess in a way it gives you access to more in a sense that, you know, now if I'm going to a destination, I'll read a whole lot of blogs and check Instagram and find where there's some great local restaurants that serve whatever is the local specialty, which if you just turned up and you didn't speak the language and you were reading your guidebook, you wouldn't ever know about, would you?
Yeah, so it does open up a lot of places that you wouldn't otherwise find. But I still think it was interesting you talked about Japan before. And I think Japan's a really good example where you can go and, for instance, you know, you could Google best restaurant in Tokyo and four or five places will come up. But if you have a local contact or you bump into someone who's there and you say, where's the best place for yakitori, whatever, and they tell you places, it's still very easy to get better information from local people. Mm. So I think you've got to just be a bit smart about it. I find with things like TripAdvisor and those general types of review places, often the first places that come up aren't that great.
Definitely.
And I because often, they're popular, it doesn't mean they're good. I mean, you think about the Sydney example and you think some of Sydney's most popular restaurants are probably our worst restaurants, the places that tourists go to. Yeah. And some of Sydney's best restaurants, quirkiest restaurants, might not necessarily be the ones that pop up originally. So you've got to...
And you've got to think about the people who are doing the reviews as well. There was a review of a place in Spain that I really love and someone had given it one star. I actually love reading the one-star reviews because they're usually hilariously ridiculous. And this one, they'd given it one star and they were complaining because the vegan options were terrible. It's like, it's not a vegan restaurant. It's a Spanish restaurant. They don't do a lot of that stuff there.
And there is a lot of that with the internet, isn't there? Like, it's unfiltered, so you're getting everybody's point of view. So you've got to try and use it a little bit intelligently.
And, I mean, I think what it comes down to is where is your personal setting on this? Like, if you... As we all used to do once upon a time, because it was the only way to do it, you were in some town somewhere and you would pick a restaurant at random because you have no information. And it's like, what's it going to be? If you have a bad or mediocre meal, are you going to be really grumpy about it? And are you going to talk about that for the rest of the week? Or if you have an outstanding meal, are you going to, man, I just lucked out? You know, it's like, can you roll with the positives or will you dwell on the negatives?
Yeah. Do you guys remember changing currency in Europe?
Yes.
Yes. Changing your guilders for your Deutschmarks into
trying to work out what was cheap and what was expensive.
That's right. What's the exchange rate here?
Being an Austrian, thinking something was great value and then ordering it. And then after you'd order it, kind of worked out, I've just paid like $25 for a beer. And it was by that stage, it was too late. So you had to just print and bear it.
Yes, pulling coins out of your wallet and holding them up to people and them just shaking their head. No, you can't spend that one. How about this one? Yeah, all right, we'll take that one.
Yeah, changing currency was a big deal. Yeah. You know, trying to get currency, travelers' checks, trying to cash.
That's true. I mean, money in general was a lot more difficult, wasn't it?
Yeah. There was no ATMs, so you know you couldn't just get yourself out of trouble, and you had to carry cash or you know travelers' checks, but. Often you had to carry cash and sometimes in three or four different currencies. So.
And when you wanted to change that cash, you had to go to the bank, which was open from 10 till 4.
Yeah.
You know, and there were probably separate queues. And then the person who was actually usually changed the money was off with a broken leg. And then someone else was going, Austrian shillings? We don't change Austrian shillings. And you're going, you're a bank. Come on, change my Austrian shillings.
And once again, there are actually places in the world where you can still have that experience. I've just come back from Uzbekistan, where there are a couple of ATMs, but they're generally, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. So it's a very much a cash-based society. And so you have to organize to get to a bank and you have to take your US dollars and they will give you an enormous stack of bills that you have to keep in a briefcase, basically, for the rest of your trip. And it really takes you back to that old time.
The US dollar always used to be king. It always used to, especially, particularly in Eastern Europe, you know, and there was the thing of like the official rate would be 5. And if you change on the black market, it would be 120.
Right. And or if you have a nice crisp $100 bill, you'll get a better rate than if you have, you know, wrinkled old 20s.
Oh, and there's still, I was in Bolivia last year and it was like the US dollars when I, you know, towards the end of the trip and I was out of local currency and it was like I was doing film conversions because it was like, okay, will I change this or whatever? And they'll take the money. They'll take US money. If it's perfect, and they will examine the edges to see if there's a little microscopic. And it's like, I got this out of an ATM in LA. What is your problem?
It couldn't be more American if it was wearing a hat. guys, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap up, but I really appreciated your time today. We're going to finish up with just one thing that you guys can name for me. The thing that you miss from the 80s and 90s the least. What are you really pleased has changed about travel?
Okay, can I go back a little bit further?
Absolutely.
I'm going to, 80s maybe. First plane trip to Europe, 36 hours, 2 stops. And I believe it cost $2,000 return, which is pretty much what you're paying now.
Right.
So the speed and the affordability of travel.
Yeah, right. Yep. How about for you, Liam?
I think the breakdown of the dominance of Lonely Planet. Mm-hmm. I think it was such an amazing product, but it just was so ubiquitous and so dominant. And it's great to see now that people are doing all kinds of different things in all kinds of different ways. And we don't have to rely on one primary source of information. And I don't miss that at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Uta, I'm going to touch on something that you mentioned as well. For me, it's price. It's just the fact that, you know, my dad was telling me when he first started traveling, when he was a kid, it cost basically the price of a house to fly from Australia over to the UK. and now we can do it for, you know, a week's wages, essentially. It's pretty amazing. So, guys, thank you again for joining me. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Ben.
If you'd like to read any more great travel stories about the 80s and 90s, or even about now, you can find it at traveller.com.au. To subscribe to Flight of Fancy, you can find us on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. And we'll see you next time on Flight of Fancy.